Does it take to decline 600 million rand? That's something BBC Jonas knows all about. He's got a new book out, After Dawn, Hope After State Capture. You remember, of course, that is exactly what happened when he was offered the position of finance minister by the Gupta family. And that's when I suppose it became really clear to him and certainly many others in this country just how much trouble we were in. He joins us now on the line, the former deputy finance minister. Good morning to you and thank you for your time.
Good morning, Mungani. Thank you for your time.
Your book opens up with exactly that moment, and it remains, I think, a seminal one in October 2015, when we then, of course, heard later what had transpired. Just take us through, I mean, I know you've spoken about this several times, but just take us through what was going on through your mind as that kind of thing was happening?
Well, I think in the first instance, it almost like destroyed any sense of hope about the ANC and government's ability to deal with the challenges of unemployment, inequality, and the challenges of development in general. But it also dashed any ethical value that I saw within the ruling party at that point in time. And actually set in motion a whole process of trying to rediscover and understand what was going on in the country, but also try to link it to what was going on globally. In a sense, it was useful, I think, because it created a whole new dimension and a more realistic assessment of what was happening, and hence the book.
One of the difficulties that we all have to contend with is that obviously and thankfully someone like you turned down the offer, but one can only try and imagine how many others did not.
Look, I mean, it's in the nature of politics. I mean, you'd have extremes all the time. Those who participate, and I think there's pressure to participate, and there's also incentive to participate. In the state capture and corruption, but also there is a real value in preserving what the ANC stands for and what the whole transformation and revolutionary process stood for.
So your book obviously tries to paint a picture that it's not all doom and gloom, that our opportunities will outweigh our weaknesses. Part of my difficulty with that analysis is the fact that we're now having non-debates, not about the issues that really confront this economy and this country. We're having non-debates around, for example, the latest issue is the funding of individuals, the CR17 campaign to be specific. And so it seems to me that our politicians, certainly even the president, people are trying to get his eye off the ball, as it were, instead of dealing with the things that we need to confront. And that may, in fact, be our undoing.
Look, I mean, that's probably the basis and the reason why I actually worked on the book. But again, understand again that there is a general, if you like, globally, a general sense that there are no big ideas about how to deal with inequality, disillusionment with elites and formal politics. And it seems it's only populists who seem to be providing false hope about what could happen. So the essence then is that people tend to force everybody to look away from these real fundamental issues, because it's not fashionable to deal with them, because they are too complex, and people would like to focus on things that are simple, straightforward, and therefore avoid all complexities, as it were. And that's why you have Trump elsewhere. It's why, I mean, you have Brexit in Britain, and that's why you have seen a wave in Poland and other parts of the world of this thing. In South Africa, it's expressing itself quite strongly. There is no overarching conversation about where we are as a country and what are the pressures and dynamics and how can we get out of where we are. And the tendency, of course, is that we must find scapegoats. It's either it's white monopoly capital, it's either it's Ramaphosa who's not servicing or serving the interests of the poor, or it's either people who are committed to neoliberalism, etc., or it's either the land question, etc. And that enable many to kind of force us away from real issues and the resolution of those issues. And in the book, I think I'm saying the danger is if we continue in the trend, we are heading for a major destructive disruption.
But have we had enough of an honest conversation, though, quite apart from those issues, about how it is that we got to this situation in the first instance? If you look at the state-owned enterprises, the growing burden of debt that you describe in your book, I mean, we've had senior business people just last week, in fact, warning of the fact that if we don't fix these, we really do face the prospect of the Minister of Finance going with a begging bowl to Washington.
I think if you think about my point of departure is that we were able to sustain political and economic stability up to 2008 on the basis that there was an overarching national consensus about where we're going, which is what I call the 94 consensus. And my sense is that I think even if you think about it, around that time, the Thabo Mbeki actually came with what was called the skisa, which actually was a recognition that you needed to do a rethink of where we're going. You needed to start a new dialogue about where society in South Africa is going. Unfortunately, what follows that point was not a conversation about how can we maintain national consensus and how can we revisit the positions that were taken in 94 in order to actually spare a new kind of trust of growth and development. What we entered was a period, what I would call losing hope and devastation, weakening of state institutions and growing inequality, etc. So the point I'm making is that, yes, there has been a lot of conversation, but these are snippets, quite frankly, by individual sectors. As a country, we are at a point where there is no overarching national agenda to which all of us subscribe. Think about it. NDP was supposed to be that centerpiece. It has failed to achieve that. I mean, because it's been shot at a different direction. So there is no, we're at a space where actually if government puts out a document to say this is where we want to go, it is a government document. It is certainly not a national document. And I think the argument throughout the book is that we've got to force a national conversation that leads us to a national consensus that begins to deal with this issue.
Is that national consensus possible? I mean, there are real consequences to what you've described, the period in which institutions were being wrecked, for example. Unemployment now is a big reality, but also the exclusion of young people from this economy. You've got a chapter in your book where you talk about the fact that we have schools, but no learning. A lot of the people that are coming into the job market, or who should be, don't have skills that the market requires. And we're sitting on this powder keg and having non-conversations when really the need of the hour is, as you say, a national consensus and all hands on deck. In this current climate, I'm afraid, though, it doesn't seem very possible.
Look, Bongani, I think we gradually are at a point where we need to realize that the crisis is existential. It is existential for the ANC. If the ANC doesn't realize that the solution does not necessarily lie in the ANC alone, or if we don't realize that we need to move beyond over-personalization, either saying that it was Zuma who caused the problem and Cyril who must solve the problem, but the nation must be dragged and trusted into a conversation. If we don't do that, quite frankly, we are heading for a major destructive disruption. And secondly, I think unemployment and inequality, I mean, is growing, as you have indicated. But more importantly, I think all the organizations that are part and constituencies that are part of the 94 consensus are actually at a disruptive phase. I mean, we've lost, I think if you think about it, the last elections, what they show, if anything, is that there is disillusionment with formal politics. And I mean, in 2018, there was a study done by Afrobarometer, which actually came to the conclusion that 63% of South Africans were saying they were willing to forgo elections in favor of a non-elected leader of government, which was able to impose law and order and provide housing and jobs. That tells you that there is growing frustration in formal politics. And if not managed and confronted, we're heading for a major crisis. And government plans to date, I mean, everything that we put forward, whether it's a 9-point plan, whether this whatever plan that we've produced.
Yeah.
The weakness of all of these plans are plans that are generated in boardrooms and not involving the entire cross-section of society, and therefore creating a momentum that people begin to realize and accept that our future is bleak if we don't work together.
I'm afraid Tabisi Jonas will have to leave it there. The former Deputy Finance Minister, his new book is called After Dawn, Hope After State Capture. Everything I've just heard him say indicates, in fact, the very opposite after state capture. I'm afraid if we're not going to have consensus in the governing party, never mind amongst the political classes, our future indeed may be bleak.